Good morning, Your Honors. Nathaniel Deakins, registration number 38752 on behalf of Mr. Roman. Just a brief recital of the facts to orient the court. This is the situation in which there was a dispute between Mr. Roman and his fiancée, the victim, and she described an intentional attack with a knife. Mr. Roman described something quite different, which is an unintentional injury to the victim. Mr. Roman at trial requested the lesser included offense instruction for second degree assault reckless and also second degree assault causing bodily injury. The trial court instructed the jury on the lesser, of course this is for the charge of first degree assault, intentionally causing serious bodily injury with a deadly weapon. The trial court instructed the jury on the lesser included offense of second degree assault causing bodily injury, but not the reckless form of second degree assault, which was essentially Mr. Roman's theory of trial. This is consistent with his theory of defense instruction. Our argument here today is that that was an error, that was reversible error on that charge. As well, Mr. Roman also requested a heat of passion mitigating circumstance instruction, which was supported by some credible evidence, and the trial court denied that instruction as well. Essentially, what the trial court, in my view, what the trial court did was focus on one inference from the testimony. I'm not sure if this court, if Your Honors remember the trial court's ruling, but essentially, with respect to each instruction requested that was denied, the trial court said, well, I'm not going to give that. Mr. Roman testified here at trial. He said he didn't do anything, which is not quite accurate in that Mr. Roman described his version of events, which supported the instructions. Mr. Roman stated that he came home from work, and this is in the context of his relationship with the victim. He believed they were engaged to be married. Well, they were engaged to be married. He believed they were getting married, and these plans were progressing. He discovered some text messages between the victim and an ex-boyfriend who the text messages revealed she was likely still involved with, and also that she was planning on leaving him, taking their child, that she was threatening Mr. Roman that he would never see his son again. And he became upset, angry, confused. He grabbed a knife from the kitchen, and there was a confrontation with the victim. Mr. Roman's version of events, and I think this is what the judge was indicating with its ruling, is that he said he held the knife pointed towards himself and that he intended to kill himself or was threatening to kill himself. He was confused, and he and the victim engaged then in a struggle. So again, essentially, I think what the trial court was saying was Mr. Roman testified here today that he didn't do anything, meaning that he didn't testify here on the stand today that he intentionally assaulted the victim. But that's not necessary to receive these instructions. His theory of defense was that he engaged in this confrontation with the victim and that if he injured her, it was an accident.
He claimed that he was trying to kill himself, didn't he?
He never said that he tried to kill himself. He said he was thinking about it and that he was considering killing himself. He told the victim, well, I'm just going to kill myself. And she said, well, go ahead and do it. And she got into his face and said, I don't care, and started poking him in the chest and taunting him essentially and saying, do it, because you're not going to be around anyway. And those circumstances all taken together provide some credible evidence for the heat of passion mitigating circumstance, as well as the reckless second degree assault.
Do you have, pardon me for interrupting, counsel, I'm sorry, but do you have other facts in the record to which you would point to support the reckless instruction?
Aside from Mr. Roman's testimony?
Yes, sir.
I came in here, you know, that's the essential focus of my argument. The I mean, the nature of the injuries, the physical injuries, potentially, well, not potentially, an inference from the injuries is that this was a struggle. Again, consistent with Mr. Roman's testimony. The injuries to the neck, of course, you know, are capable of many inferences, but one is that they were superficial injuries and they could have happened during a struggle.
Counsel,
yes,
wasn't there some evidence in the record that there was a struggle that took place through the opening of a partially closed door?
The victim testified that there was an initial struggle, I believe, in the living room or dining room, and she ran into the bedroom and either forced him out or Mr. Roman left and then tried, and she closed the door and then tried to get back in. I can't remember specifically Mr. Roman's testimony on that subject. I can't remember his specific testimony about that, but I do remember the victim testifying to that. I might be missing the relevance of that, and I apologize, but
counsel, what exactly did the defendant do, by your understanding, in the heat of passion? I'm having trouble with the heat of passion because of what, not what the trial court said, they didn't do anything. Obviously, something happened here. But the question is, what did he do allegedly in the heat of passion that would entitle him to a heat of passion instruction?
Well, the heat of passion instruction is warranted for first degree assault as well as second degree assault. So very much consistent, if you will, with his testimony of this being an accident and reckless, he's still entitled to the heat of passion instruction. My view is that he's also entitled to the heat of passion instruction for first degree assault intentionally, because it's not inconsistent with his testimony, and the four factors from Castles, which is a leading case on heat of passion, are satisfied in this case. I have a few responses from that, which is, first one is that his testimony is not inconsistent with heat of passion, and even if it is, I think he's still entitled to the instruction under Brown. But first addressing the consistency is, he said that he got into essentially a shoving match with the victim, and I think the jury can infer from that that he intended to hurt her. However, again, even if there is some inconsistency, the instruction is still warranted under Brown. I hope I answered your question, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May I ask a follow-up, please?
Yes.
His heat of passion appears to be focused on something that not necessarily the victim did, but the man whom she was seeing did. He testified that he saw the texts on the phone, which suggested that she was interested in a sexual relationship with this man, and that is what made him upset. Well, if the victim does not engage in the conduct that makes him upset, how can he raise a heat of passion argument?
I think factually, Your Honor, that's not entirely accurate. My view of the evidence presented at trial is that she was engaging in the text messaging, and that indication was that she was actively involved in a sexual relationship. Now, I'm not standing here today and saying that enough, that on its own would be enough for heat of passion. I think the cases say unrequited love, if you will, is not sufficient. So, but if you look at the events leading up to the injuries, the victim did engage in highly provoking acts, an act under the circumstances, if you will, which is that after he found out this information and called her on it or asked her about it, threatening to hurt himself, she said, "I'm leaving you, I'm taking our kid, you're not gonna see him again." And when he said, "Well, I'm just gonna kill myself then," she started poking him and pushing him in his chest, saying, "We'll do it, I don't care. You're not gonna see your son anyway, you're not gonna be around anyway, just go ahead and do it." So I think to focus exclusively on the text messages is not the best way to view it. That's part of the situation. I know in the Attorney General's answer brief, the Attorney General did talk about the text messages, but again, to parse out the acts, I don't think is required by the case law. I don't think that you point to one act and say, that's not good enough, one act, that's not good enough, one act, that's not good enough, to get the instruction, of course. What's required is a highly provoking act of the victim under the circumstances. And if you look at the series of events and culminating in the injury, this case is like Castles. Castles, in that case, there were two roommates with somewhat of a longstanding beef, if you will, culminating in one roommate shooting the other after an argument. There were some physical elements there of a confrontation. There's some name calling. And this facts of this case are similar to Castles, and unlike, I call them unrequited love. I don't know if that's appropriate, but meaning rejected advances. So this case is similar to Castles and unlike those unrequited love cases. I think the proper remedy in this case is a remand. Like the Attorney General mentioned in its answer brief, that for the prosecution to elect to retry Mr. Rahman or to accept a conviction and judgment of conviction for Class 6 felony of second-degree assault, heat of passion. Under the circumstances, both the instructions were supported by the evidence. The trial judge erred in not giving the instructions, and therefore Mr. Rahman was denied his right to a trial on those issues, which he was entitled to.
Why wouldn't the proper remedy be simply a remand for a new trial?
I think the cases cited by the Attorney General Sepulveda are appropriate.
Isn't that, though, the government's election, not yours, whether to accept the conviction or a new trial?
Yes, it is the government's, the DA's election, if you will. I do see I have a couple minutes. I wouldn't mind saving that for rebuttal.
Of course.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, William Kozlowski, registration number 37824 on behalf of the people. Defendant asserts that he's entitled to a new trial or a remand because the trial court erred in denying his request for a lesser included offense instruction on reckless second degree assault. In order to be entitled to that instruction, there must be some evidence in the record in which the jury could conclude that the victim's injuries were a result of her serious bodily injury was a result of merely defendant's reckless conduct.
Mr. Kozlowski,
yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Kozlowski, yes.
How is it that second degree assault intent, which is the instruction that was given,
right?
How is that an intermediate offense? Isn't it, in fact, the same kind of lesser included offense that second degree reckless is?
Is your question, is it an intermediate offense between first
right.
and reckless?
It's not an intermediate offense.
No, it's not. It's not.
Then how is Mata Medina even applicable to this set of facts?
Well, as it relates to harmless, is that?
That's correct.
Okay. It's not our position that the conclusion in Mata Medina compels a harmless conclusion in this case. Rather, the first holding in Mata Medina is that failure to give lesser included offense instructions is subject to harmless error review. And I don't think the Supreme Court had said that before. And in that case, that was one instance in which, when it is an intermediate offense, the Supreme Court held that it is always harmless. It's our position that under the holding that it's subject to harmless error, then this court can look to all the circumstances at trial, including the evidence, the defendant's theory, and the verdict that was given, to conclude that in this situation, the error was harmless.
Well, how can we be reasonably certain that the jury wouldn't have considered recklessness in an entirely different light, particularly given the testimony of the defendant in this case?
Well, first I would say that his testimony was not, I would disagree with counsel that his testimony reflected that it was the result of reckless conduct. It was the trial, it's our position that the instruction was not warranted in the first place, because his testimony was that he pointed the knife at himself and then she came at him, and he affirmatively testified that she grabbed the knife.
She grabbed the knife in his hands. And his testimony, as I understand the record, is that he wasn't trying to cut her. He wasn't intending to harm her.
Right.
She harmed herself by grabbing the knife.
Right, so it's her conduct that causes her injuries, not his. That's,
well, that may very well be, but how does that undermine the concept of recklessness?
Well, if in order to be convicted of reckless, your conduct must first create the substantial and unjustifiable
risk. He has the knife.
Right. And then your conduct must also cause the injury. If she reaches out and grabs the knife, you can't be convicted criminally culpable if someone else's conduct causes their own injury. Does that answer your question?
But if there was a scuffle, and what brought it into being was him deciding to pick up that knife, and then stuff happens in a scuffle like that, why wasn't the jury entitled to determine whether or not his conduct was reckless rather than intentional?
Well, I guess it's still, his conduct still has to cause the injury. And even, let's assume that him picking up the knife creates a substantial and unjustifiable harm. Unless that conduct of picking up the knife also causes her injury, then it's, I guess, look at it this way. If we just had his testimony in a videotape or something, and he was only charged with reckless, I think it would be insufficient evidence to conclude that he was guilty of reckless assault, in that he's saying, I pointed the knife at myself, she came at me and grabbed the knife.
Let me ask you a hypothetical, if I may, please.
Sure.
What if the facts were that he picked up the knife and he jabbed it at her and she grabbed the blade? And let's assume that was the only injury. Her hand was cut by the knife. Now, clearly you have her conduct grabbing the blade, but you have his conduct in jabbing it at her. Wouldn't that be reckless?
Yes, and that is different from this case. There's no testimony that he I think he specifically...
I understand, but I ask that question because you made the statement that if someone else's conduct causes the injury, then it can't be reckless. Well, in that hypothetical, it clearly is reckless.
I would agree with that, and I guess my answer would be that his conduct and her conduct caused the injury. And he testified, he was asked, you took the knife and started using it towards her as she grabbed the blade, and his answer was no.
I also want to ask a question piggybacking on a question that Judge Graham asked about Mata Medina. I'm concerned about the argument that, although I agree with you that harmless error applies, but there's the further suggestion that by rejecting the lesser included offense of intentionally of the use of the deadly weapon, intentionally causing bodily harm, that necessarily it rejects the reckless one. And don't we have two problems with that? First of all, these are co-equal. They're both class 4 felonies. And second, they've got a different element, which is one has bodily injury and one has serious bodily injury. So help me, please, with how that argument works.
Sure. Well, it's certainly, it's not our position that it necessarily rejects the death. It's that, it's our position that this court must look to the entire record, including the verdict and the evidence at trial, in concluding, to conclude that this is harmless. And basically, I think you need to look to the entire point, as defendant acknowledges in his brief, is that we give lesser included offense instructions because the Supreme Court and the legislature have judged that there's a risk that there's a distortion in the jury's fact-finding process, that they're going to think that the defendant is guilty of something, and if they only have a all or nothing choice, that they're going to convict him of the charged offense even though they think he's not guilty of it. So it's our position that you need to look to the record to see if that concern was covered or not. So here, the jury's rejection of attempted first-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, and choosing first-degree assault over second-degree assault demonstrates that any error in failing to give the other second-degree assault instruction was harmless. Essentially, merely because the second-degree assault was intentional rather than reckless does not diminish the reliability of the verdict for first-degree assault. Basically, the jury's rejection of the second-degree assault actually given always carries an implication, that implication being that they're following the instructions. And I think there's a Supreme Court case cited in Mata Medina that I think is helpful, that it's the Shad case, Shad versus Arizona. In that case, the defendant was charged with first-degree murder and felony murder, and he got a lesser-included offense instruction on second-degree murder. And he argued to the Supreme Court, I was, as a matter of due process, it wasn't a statutory thing, but as a matter of due process, I'm entitled to a robbery instruction as well. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument and essentially said, we can trust this verdict. And in that it said, we would have to assume that the jury was unconvinced the defendant was guilty of either intentional murder or second-degree murder, but was loath to acquit him completely because they were convinced he was guilty of robbery. So they might choose capital murder than second-degree murder as its means of keeping him off the streets. We can see no basis to assume such a rationality. And I think that applies here. If the jury, basically the question in this case is, assuming that he was entitled to the instruction, does this court doubt the first-degree assault conviction? And if they were unconvinced that he was convicted of first-degree assault, but they didn't want to let him go walk out the door, they would have convicted him of the second-degree assault that was actually given.
Counsel?
Yes.
Do you agree that the jury was not required to accept either all of the testimony of the victim or all of the testimony of the defendant?
Sure, yeah.
They could have decided that something slightly different happened in that struggle, is that right?
Well, I don't think, with regards to lesser included instructions, I don't think there was any basis for them to conclude that her neck injury was caused by anything other than his intentional conduct. And I think that's a basis both for not giving the reckless instruction and even if it should have been, that it's harmless. That essentially she suffered serious bodily injury that his testimony did not account for. And under the Ramirez Court of Appeals case, merely because the jury could reject uncontroverted evidence is not a basis to give a lesser included offense instruction. Turning to the heat of passion, counsel discussed a series of acts that he says constituted heat of passion. Under Sepulveda, the quote is, it must be a single highly provoking act. So if he's pointing to three or four acts, then that's insufficient on its face. In addition, neither under his testimony nor her testimony was he in fact acting under a heat of passion. Her testimony was he came in, closed all the windows, and acted in a very calculating manner and then assaulted her. His testimony was, his testimony was not even that he was in a passion because of the text. He read them, and he said he went in and tried to talk to her. She got mad at him, and he tried to calm the situation, which is the opposite of acting in a heat of passion. As opposed to, I believe in Castles, there was testimony that the defendant lost it. There's no such testimony here. And under the Supreme Court Ramirez case, essentially, no matter how harsh words are in a breakup, as a matter of law, that's insufficient to warrant a heat of passion instruction. That's particularly true of words that aren't even directed at the defendant. It's essentially a conversation that he overhears between other two people. And finally, defendant relies on the point that she poked him in the chest, but that was a result of his provoking act of pointing the gun or the knife at himself. So he can't rely on his provoking act in order to mitigate an assault on the victim. And the court has no further questions. We ask that you affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kozlowski. Mr. Deakins, you have 2 minutes and 18 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to speak to a broader point that I think addresses the harmlessness, I do agree that the standard is harmless error. A long line of cases, in fact, pretty much every case I've seen says when the instruction is warranted and it wasn't given, it's reversible as to that issue. I would also point out that the denial of these instructions completely undermined the defendant's case, because his theory of the case instruction is a case study on recklessness. In fact, the judge's factual findings about why recklessness wasn't warranted is also, I mean, it sounds reckless to me. Defendant picks up a knife, brings it to the fight, gets into a shoving match, doesn't drop it, and the victim's injured. And Judge Graham, I'm having a flashback to the record here. I'm not sure if this is exactly what you were getting at, but I do believe that there was blood found in the house, DNA that supports Mr. Roman's theory of the case as to where the blood was found. So I'm not sure if that's what you were getting at, but that would be evidence that supports Mr. Roman's theory of the case. The Attorney General essentially concedes that they're not relying on the intermediate offense principle, but yet asks this court to expand the intermediate offense principle. The intermediate offense doctrine is necessarily it's a logical progression that either necessarily rejects the denied lesser included or doesn't. And in this case, it doesn't, and therefore he was entitled to it. Also, I just wanted to point out that the Attorney General said it's up to this court to determine whether there was doubt about the conviction, but the standard is whether there's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the jury's conviction. Again, as I said, the jury wasn't given the legal option to accept Mr. Roman's theory of the case, as well as the heat of passion mitigator. And for those reasons, we ask that this court reverse the judgment and remand the case.
Thank you, Mr. Deakins.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, gentlemen. We appreciate it very, very much. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Please have a safe journey home. Council will